I'm Derek Jensen. This is Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. My guest today is Genevieve Gluck. Genevieve Gluck is a feminist essayist and researcher who in recent years has primarily been looking at the influence of pornography on gender identity. She hosts the podcast Women's Voices and has written for Feminist Current and Graham Linehan's blog and on Substack at GenevieveGluck.substack.com. GenevieveGluck.substack.com. So first off, thank you for your work in the world. And second, thank you for being on the program.
Thank you for having me.
So the first question is, can you talk a little bit about can you introduce the relationship between patriarchy and a hatred of the body and a hatred of the embodied? It seems there's that seems to be somewhere near the center of patriarchy, at least to me.
Right. So there's a kind of splitting between the body and the selfhood within patriarchy. And some people might know this as what's called Cartesian dualism, which comes from Descartes, although the concept itself is much older than Descartes when he first spoke about it. But basically, it means that there's this division between the body and the mind. And this kind of splitting or division has allowed for a lot of abuses, human rights abuses, animal abuses, and so on, because of the concept of this body as a vessel. And we see this applied to women constantly throughout history, where the notion that a woman is simply a body, a vessel, a host, whereas the male is thought to be as sort of this logical, rational, and focused heavily on thinking with the mind. And like I said, this division allows for control. It allows for dissociation. Especially you can convince people to more readily accept inhumane conditions if they've already dissociated and do not believe themselves to be worthy of respect or full humanity, full human dignity. And part of what this does too is it allows for the corporate takeover over individuals as well, which is something that I think we can talk about in more detail later. But what are the reasons for it? Well, the reasons for it, like I said, are control, obviously. So in a patriarchal society, men have the control, whereas women do not. So it's really important to understand as well that women's reproductive power plays a large role in this. Women can reproduce in ways that men cannot. Men are dependent on women in order to continue their genetic line. Women can always be certain that a child will carry their DNA, whereas men do not have that certainty, which is one of the main reasons for patriarchy to establish this paternity certainty. And there seems to be this thread throughout history of connected with patriarchy of a kind of envy of women's reproductive power. And that envy leads to the devaluing of women's power and the devaluing of women and reducing them simply to bodies or vessels.
So before we go on with that, I want to jump in for a second and talk about a couple of things to show how pervasive this is. And one of them is the great chain of being, which is, you know, a couple of thousand years old, this notion that there's a hierarchy of perfection. And I think it infuses almost every part of this culture, where there's a hierarchy of perfection where you have God at the top and God is completely disembodied, and then the angels, and then humans, especially men, and then women, and then non-human animals, and then plants, and then soil, and then sand, basically. And there's other gradations in between. But the point is, the top, the perfect, is the perfect mind. And at the bottom is pure matter, according to this idea, pure matter with no mind, with humans being a battleground between mind and body, and men representing the mind and women representing the body more. But that notion underlies everything till today, where we presume that, you know, humans are smarter than non-humans, where we presume that humans don't have lives that are valuable to them. It's and not only that, but these days in this more secularized perspective, the notion of God has kind of been replaced by machines. That, you know, now the machines are at the top. Machines are more reliable. We want to have this artificial intelligence. We want to merge with the machines and live forever. You know, there's all this. Anyway, so that's one thing I wanted to say. So do you want to take that anywhere?
Yeah, that's a really interesting concept, one I hadn't heard before, but it makes perfect sense now that you lay it out like that, that the, especially the AI and the technology becoming this kind of godlike figure in society these days where it's pure rationality, right? So therefore it must be more, I don't know, higher, transcendent of our human form. And like you had mentioned, I think you're probably familiar with, I don't know if your listeners are familiar with the Terrasem cult by Martin Rothblatt, where he's trying to develop a way to upload consciousness, basically turn human consciousness into something resembling technology in order to attain immortality. I mean, these concepts that we're seeing now in transhumanism specifically really show that hierarchy of reason over body very, very clearly, I think.
Yeah, which I frankly find horrifying. Mm-hmm. So that was one thing I wanted to mention. And then the other was, oh, I can't remember now. I remember what it is. Is another way that this manifests today is, I remember maybe, 15 years ago, I heard somebody ask an astronomer why we need to explore Mars. And the astronomer answered, to answer that most important question of all, which is, are we all alone? And I simultaneously laughed and felt outrage, because it's like, how can you ask if we're all alone when we're surrounded by redwood trees and banana slugs and coho salmon and black bears and everybody else? And one more thing along these lines is that so often, scientists get really, really excited when they are able to make some enzymes in a laboratory, and they'll say, we're so close to creating life. And it's like, yeah, rabbits and mice create life all the time, and nobody thinks that's a miracle. Nobody in the scientific community thinks it's a miracle. And so that's just for me an example of how, if it's created by our minds, then it's worth something. And if it's not, I want to give one more example of this, and then I'll shut up and we can do the interview of you, which is that when I was writing my book, Myth of Human Supremacy, there were some places where I was writing about the greatest inventions of all time and also the greatest pieces of art. And when we think about the greatest pieces of art, we usually think, I don't know, the Mona Lisa or, you know, some other, or Beethoven's Ninth or whatever it is. And we don't think about birdsong. We don't think about a sunset. We don't think about the colors of trees in the fall. And simultaneously, when we think of the greatest inventions of all time, we think of, I don't know, the wheel, the lever, the screw, the water pump, the gunpowder, I don't know. And we don't think about proprioception. We don't think about sex, which is a pretty good invention. We don't think about any of the things that nature created. Those aren't inventions, because the body created them, and they weren't created by our wonderful little minds. So those are just more manifestations of this same hatred, I believe, of the embodied, or at the very least, the dismissal of the embodied. If a human creates a painting of a sunset, that's a beautiful thing. If nature creates a sunset, well, that has no meaning. In fact, I read one quote somewhere where they said all meaning. I'll just say this. And there was back when I was taught at the university, there was a philosopher in the next office over. And I used to get so frustrated with him when we would chat sometimes, because he kept saying, all meaning comes from humans. I would say, are you saying that blue whales have no meaning except as humans assign it? He said, absolutely. And I kept wanting to go in with a hammer and smash the hammer on his thumb and say, did you decide that this has meaning, or does not having your thumb smashed by a hammer have meaning of its own? And it's just, anyway, so I'm sorry to derail your interview. So you can take that body hatred anywhere you want.
Well, yeah, you're absolutely right about, you know, the concept of the coming from the mind or something that's made by men having more supposed value than something made by nature, right? That's the devaluation of women that comes into play, because while women can't control pregnancy or women don't specifically decide how to navigate their pregnancy, it's something that their body does. Therefore, it's not worth anything according to patriarchy. And you can see that too in even like folklore myths, right? So the myth of Zeus and Athena. So in that folklore, Athena, the goddess of wisdom, sprang fully born out of Zeus's head. So there's also this concept that men give birth in a way, but when men give birth, it's through their minds, and therefore it's a higher sort of birthing than women's birth, because that's through the body. Yes. So that thread just is a constant throughout patriarchy, and the I believe Mary Daly had called this like a patriarchal reversal, where even in the Bible, the fact that a woman was created from a man, when in reality, we know all men are made in the bodies of women. All men are made in the image and bodies of women, and not the other way around. So that concept we can see replicating again with technology. So now we're going to be creating artificial intelligence, something to mirror humans, right? Well, when you have women just give birth to humans all the time, and that's not supposed to be anything worth any great value. Well, I guess some people would argue otherwise, but in general, our society doesn't seem to value life that much at all, truly.
So Let's start moving towards some of the manifestations. How are some of the ways that this hatred of the body has manifested beyond the murder of the entire planet? Of course, that's a huge manifestation of it. Can you talk about some of the ways in patriarchy? I'm thinking, you know, do you want to talk for just a moment about foot binding, or just or anything else?
I've just been sort of focused on one element of it in particular at the moment. So the general history of it all together is something that I don't quite feel totally comfortable talking about, because there's just so much of it. You know, you have the foot binding, like you said, which interestingly, a lot of people don't realize this, but with the foot binding in China, many people might be familiar with that as a concept. But there were actually sex pamphlets that were distributed around men who did this to their wives, because it was supposed to make things more pleasurable for them in bed, because the woman wasn't able to take as long strides. So she was believed to be, I kind of cringe when I'm talking about it, but that was an unknown belief of foot binding, was that it would have sexual benefits for men. And in general, yeah, we see that throughout beauty practices, of harmful beauty practices. Like I said, there's just so many of them. My brain is running through them all, trying to focus. It seems to be a common thread that you have that expression, suffer for fashion, right? Or beauty is pain. That there's some reason in particular why it is that throughout cultures, women's suffering has been framed as something beautiful, or that women are meant to suffer, that women are supposed to enjoy suffering, or perhaps that men enjoy women's suffering. This masochistic element that's really tied to patriarchy, because patriarchy is, in effect, patriarchy is sadomasochism on a grand scale. You know, the sadism being the masculine aspect of enjoying inflicting pain, and the masochistic element being the feminine, supposedly, according to this.
So I agree with you, but can you defend that statement, please? that patriarchy is sadomasochism?
Sure. Well, it's not even an original idea, to be honest. It's not my own idea. Many sexologists and psychoanalysts, perhaps famously Freud, suggested that women had a masochistic element to them naturally, that basically the natural hierarchy between the sexes was based on sadomasochism. So yeah, I don't really know where to go with that. I mean, it, to me, it's clear as day. And I often make the mistake of assuming that other people can see what I'm seeing. So if it's not clear, I guess I would just say that that this has been something that's been talked about within sexology and within religions as well, you know, that women are supposed to suffer. I mean, it goes even back to the Bible, right? Again, we can see that Eve was supposed to suffer. That was her fate. For disobeying, and the pain is inflicted by a man.
I'm thinking also about how Eric Fromm talked about how sadism is ultimately based on basically converting another living being into an object to be used, which, I mean, certainly the word objectification comes up a lot in discussing the relationship between patriarchy and women. Anyway, sorry, go ahead.
Right. So I think I want to bring this back into the conversation we were just having about technology as well, because what I see is an association between sadomasochism and dissociation. So anyone who practices BDSM will tell you about this aftercare moment. I mean, basically, BDSM is ritualized abuse, sexualized abuse, that then it follows the pattern of a narcissistic abuser where they harm you and then they apologize later and they do this thing that's called aftercare. And that is being normalized more and more, I mean, to an extent that I almost can't even hardly believe, within pornography through the internet. I want to keep bringing back the point that this is happening online, because it's really important, I think, to understand that the tool through which it's being done is also a method of causing dissociation. So the porn consumption, the BDSM, the when people practice sadomasochism, there's a term that's used. It's called subspace, which is submissive space, which is effectively a way of saying dissociation. It's just a different way of saying it. You'll find within the terminology of sadomasochism and BDSM that there are all these words that make things sound as though they're different from what they really are when you say them as their honest meanings. Anyway, so I think as well that the internet and technology is imposing dissociation on people on a grand scale through pornography in particular as one of the aspects. Of course, there are several aspects, for example, things like avatars, where we associate that image with ourselves. There's been some research, I think it's called the Proteus effect, where just using an avatar, you begin to actually act more like what you think that avatar looks like. So we're being conditioned in all of these different ways right now to dissociate from our body, to split from ourselves. And certainly I would reiterate that pornography is one of the biggest venues through which this is being done.
So let's transition to the to one of the manifestations that you've written about of this mind-body split that is pretty dramatic, that we have seen many times in the history of patriarchy, that is, I find, a very disturbing, as I find all of these very disturbing. But it has to do with the relationship between patriarchy and the mutilation of bodies, and especially the generative organs. And before we go, I want to say one thing, which is, I don't, you know, you and I have chatted a little bit about this before, and I think last time I forgot to mention that Jane Caputi wrote a really good book called The Age of Sex Crime, in which she makes a connection between unnecessary breast surgeries and hysterectomies. She wrote this back in the 90s, I believe, or 80s even, one of the two. Unnecessary breast surgeries and hysterectomies, and the use of women's body parts in advertising, and how serial sex killers often will mutilate the genitals of their victims. And the point, one of the points she was making, was that there is this drive within patriarchy, no matter what the excuse, no matter what the rationale, there's a drive in patriarchy to mutilate the body. And you have written some about that. So do you want to talk about that at all?
Sure. Yeah. It's a really heavy topic, and I just want to warn your listeners, sometimes I might say some things which could be triggering or shocking. So keep that in mind as we go. But yeah, the drive to mutilate, so I want to specifically, so the reason that, you know, you and I started talking to begin with was because I'd written this article about castration in particular. And I kind of lay it out in the sense that this is something that's happening again. And by that, I mean, I talk about some of these castration cults from history, and then I say that we're seeing this happen again. So ritual castration dates back thousands of years, and it can be traced back to 3,000, 4,000 years ago across the world. You know, China, the Byzantine, ancient Greece, Rome, Vietnam, Thailand. I mean, basically the entire world. You can't forget India in the picture too, the Hijras of India. So it's a very old practice, and it's been typically associated with creating a caste of men who did not threaten the men in power. So the ruling class, and as well, these eunuchs, these castrated men, would be used to protect the ruling figure's harem or concubines, as it were, because they were considered to be not a threat to the man in power. And even the term eunuch, some etymology can date it back to, or trace it back to, a term which means like the protector of the bed, although it's not verified. But anyway, so why am I talking about this? You might be wondering. Well, I see a parallel between the transgender movement and the eunuch cults of the past. And in particular, I really want to focus in on this one cult, which is one of the most recent modern cults, called the Skopsi, and they operated in Russia from the late 18th century up to the early 21st century, as it turns out. So a few hundred years, actually. And at
wait,
the
did
height,
you say 21st? Not
yes,
20th.
They were not totally wiped out, or apparently, or I shouldn't say wiped out, but they were continuing to operate until the early 21st century. Yes.
Okay, sorry, go ahead.
So the Skopsi were a cult in Russia, and they were a Christian in their beliefs, you know, but they also believed that Jesus Christ was castrated as well. And they practiced ritual genital mutilation in order to attain what they would call sainthood. So they went through these ceremonies of mutilation, which they called the seal or the sacred seal. And men would be castrated, but also women would have their breasts dismembered in a term they called fiery baptisms. And I'm sorry if I'm stuttering a bit here, but it's kind of a lot to talk about. And I try to choose my words carefully when I talk about these kinds of things. But basically, it revolves around the idea of a disdain for sexuality, or this idea that sexuality is sinful, that the body itself is at war with the ability for the soul to get to heaven. Common theme that we see in religion.
Which again is that same old great chain of being where the body is, the soul is perfected and goes to heaven. The body is corrupted and is something to be, in this case, burned.
Yeah, so it's just a very common theme, but the extent to which it's been used in order to enact mutilation, and particularly of the genitals, sort of, it's kind of shocking. Once you start to look into this, you see actually quite how common this concept is. And I was shocked when I looked into this to find that some of these cults are still operating today. I mean, in 2017, there was a guru in India who was arrested for castrating men, his male followers. So it's not gone out of fashion. You know, we tend to think of these things as, oh, the Byzantine Empire or ancient China, but no, they're going on right now as well. And I did want to point out in regards to the Scopsy, in particular, there's a woman by the name of Laura Engelstein who has done some research on them, although in general, it is kind of difficult to find information about them. But in her research, she points out that children were recruited into the Scopsy cult because the men were infertile. So they were rendered unable to reproduce through this process. The women were not, obviously, but the men were. And so children were recruited through apprenticeships. So they would come to work for someone in the cult as an apprentice or a servant, and then they would be indoctrinated. And then when these children were later questioned in court, they all said that they had sought out castration of their own free will. They said that it was their choice. Also, the Scopsy recruited criminals and fugitives and would change their documents and change their identities. And another interesting thing to point out, too, is that one of the rituals of the Scopsy involved the men after castration being dressed as a woman and paraded through town in a show of effectually self-flagellation, masochism, lowering of the status. But the reason that they were successful in recruiting children to the cult was because they were seen as saints, basically. They were admired as having a particular moral fortitude that others did not.
So before we go on, when you say that there was the cult of the Scopsy, were there like 15 of them? I mean, were there?
No. So they would operate kind of like on the fringes and not in the central cities, right? But at the peak, there were about 100,000 members of the cult.
So it's a lot.
A lot, and going on for centuries as well. Like I said, exact numbers are kind of hard to find. Documentation is kind of hard to find, but from what we do know, they were not this small outsider. Well, they were outsiders technically, but not a fringe movement in particular. I did want to bring up too, I learned this recently and I found this interesting, maybe you will as well, but the Heaven's Gate cult practiced castration. Actually, the founder, Applewhite, he castrated, I think he castrated himself in 1996. And then he had a few other members castrated because he believed that his concept of heaven called the next level would be free from gender.
Well, this makes me think of, I mean, there's a line that's a pretty famous line from Matthew that in the Bible that you also quote in the essay that first had us get in contact. And that's, there are castrates who are castrated by others, and there are castrates who castrated themselves for the kingdom of God. And I mean, there's a pretty famous notion of eunuchs for the kingdom of heaven. And I mean, so my point is that yes, we can get horrified at the Skopsy, but again, this is a pattern. And like you said, this goes back to China. It goes to India. It's mentioned in the Bible. It was not unknown for early saints of the Christian church to castrate themselves. There is this long war on the body.
Yes, and in particular, it's about control as well, right? So we can see that, especially with the eunuchs of the ancient empires, where it was very obviously about controlling people. Control of sexuality is something that's been well established to be a part of religious control, and as well the castration. So
I know, you know, before we actually turned on the recorder, you said that you wanted this to be more of a regular conversation than an interview, which is one reason I'm yakking so much. But this makes me want to bring up something by, do you know about St. Augustine and his unruly penis?
No.
Oh, this is great. This is a quote by St. Augustine. When the first man transgressed the law of God, he began to have another law in his members. Members, we know what he's talking about. Which was repugnant to the law of his mind. And he felt the evil of his own disobedience when he experienced the disobedience in his flesh, a most righteous retribution recoiling on himself. When it must come to man's great function, the procreation of children, the members which were expressly created for this purpose will not obey the direction of the will, but lust has to be waited for to set these members in motion, as if it had legal right over them, and sometimes it refuses to act when the mind wills. Well, often it acts against its will, ! Must not this bring the blush of shame over the freedom of the human will, that by its contempt of God, its own commander, it has lost all proper command for itself over its own members? Now, wherein could be found a more fitting demonstration of the just deprivation of human nature by reason of its disobedience than in the disobedience of those parts? So the point is that because he would get unwanted erections, and because he would also not get erections when he wanted to, that he actually thought that God had given men a disobedient organ to remind them that disobedience to the Father was the original sin. I just find that an absolutely extraordinary thing that, and again, this is not new to me. I think I first encountered this in Susan Griffin's writing, where that's part of, his penis did not obey his mind. And that is yet another of this war against, you know, if the penis does not obey the mind, therefore that's another sign of man's disobedience to God and of the body's, the body not conforming to our will. And I find that just so striking and in a sense terrifying.
Yeah, well, there it is. There it is, out laid out like it is. That's a thought that had occurred to me too, and I'm glad that you brought it up, because it does seem as though the striving for control over the body is related somewhat specifically to male anatomy in particular. I mean, we can see that women are connected to our bodies in ways that men are not. Through our menstrual cycles and through pregnancy and childbirth and so on, there's this sort of groundedness that women have in our bodies. And this idea that an inability to control libido or erection posits the man as against himself. Then having that idea extended over to women and children, as though we're having the same problem. I'm sorry to laugh, but I feel like that's really kind of a root of it all.
Well, it's not simply not being able to control women and children, but also, I have mentioned before in public that I often see bears here, and I will see a bear, and then I might see that bear fairly often for a while, and then I might not ever see that bear again. And the point is, the bear is wild. I wrote a book on zoos, and there's I had to go to a zoo in order to write the book. And at the zoo, there was this little display where there was a sing-song voice would say, all the animals at the zoo are waiting here just for you. And that just horrified me, because that's the essence of it, is you're controlling the animals in the zoo, but in wild nature, that's the thing. They're wild. You might see a bear and you might think you have a relationship with this bear, and then you might never see the bear again. And it might be because the bear is dead. It might be because the bear went to a different valley, and you might never know. And that's the thing with wild nature, is that, oh, I was seeing this thing a couple years ago about how this guy wants to control hurricanes. And that's the thing, is that nature isn't controllable. And when we try to control it, we kill it. And, you know, a parking lot is much more controllable than a prairie. And so it's not just women. My point is, it's everything. And sadism is really the attempt to control another living being. And this is all wrapped up in the same thing, I think.
Yeah, it's all about control at the end of it. And the article that you contacted me about was, I titled it Castrating Children in the Service of Male Sexuality, because I think that, should I just jump into it then? Because I think that that's what's happening here with the transgender child.
Well, before we go there, I want you to say one more thing that you said before we turned the recorder on, that I want to make sure it gets in the interview, because I thought it was so brilliant. Can you say the thing that you said to me and that you wrote down?
Yeah.
Sorry to be so vague.
So we were talking a couple weeks ago, and we were talking about this concept of, you know, the gender ideology movement in general, and why it is so vociferous, why it is so, what's the right word? Why there's so much anger behind it, and why it is so difficult to reason with people once they've accepted this ideology. And what I said was that they need an enemy, and the enemy that they've come up with is reality. So anyone who is still living within reality is in another plane from them. And so they're going to constantly keep fighting, and they'll always have something to fight against when what you're fighting against is material reality.
And I just want to say explicitly that that's also one reason this culture is killing the planet, is because it is a fight against material reality, and you can't win. And even if you win in a fight against material reality, it means you've destroyed, in this case, the capacity of the planet to support life. This is a losing battle from the beginning.
Right. And well, within gender ideology too, you're destroying the reproductive function as well. I mean, it renders people infertile. So you're destroying life and the ability to create life within humans at the same time. And why is it that they're denying that biology is real? You know, they'll say biology is a social construct at the very same time that we're wiping out biology. We're seeing a huge extinction of biodiversity. It's pure denialism.
Yeah. And I just want to say before you launch into this more with the article, I just want to also say that if sex itself is a social construct, how did Tyrannosaurus rexes, whom they don't believe had society, how did they ever reproduce? How does anybody who doesn't have a society reproduce if sex is a social construct? It's stunning to me that they're attempting to deny. What? When was the first sexual reproduction on the planet? A billion years ago? Half a billion years ago? Literally hundreds of millions of years of evolution they're denying. Anyway, so go ahead.
Right. So I wanted to use the SCOPSE as the backdrop to bring in the concept of the transgender child. And specifically, I want to start with John Money, because John Money had established this idea of what he called the Scoptic syndrome, which was named after the Scopsy cult. And it's defined as a renunciation of sex and a sexual body image syndrome with degrees of severity, fixation, neurosis, psychosis, particularly on castration and genital self-mutilation as a pathology. And John Money is known for being the sexologist who coined the term gender identity. He did horrific research on children in order to establish his view that, like we said, that sex is a social construct, but in particular, he believed that gender identity had to do with actual sex, like sexual reproduction. And in his most famous case, he took these twin boys, the Reimer boys, and one of the boys had a botched circumcision. So he tried to raise that boy as a little girl named Brenda. And he would have the children act out what he called copulation play and take photographs of them while doing this. So I mention this too because there is this tendency these days for people to say that gender identity has nothing to do with sex or sexuality, which is just baffling because they're always banging on about it. But it certainly does. And in its roots, we can see that from its very, very conception, the idea of gender identity had to do with the male sexual role and the female sexual role. So basically sadomasochism again. Quite clear to me in the work of John Money to see sadomasochism there again. So anyway, he had this idea of the Skoptic syndrome. The Skoptic syndrome was placed in the DSM as a part of the gender identity disorder, and it was later removed. So I believe it was removed in the DSM-5, but it was in the DSM-4. I should explain too, the DSM, the Diagnostic and Statistic Manual, which is used to diagnose people with certain mental conditions. So we have the SCOPSI cult, we have the naming of the Skoptic syndrome, we have that listed as a part of the gender identity disorder in the DSM. It later gets removed, and when it's removed, the concept of the transgender child is introduced. So it follows this certain linear progression all within a few decades, basically.
And keep going with that.
So why am I talking about castration and transgender children? Well, okay, so puberty blockers, right? So for those who don't know what puberty blockers are, that's just a euphemistic name for drugs, one of which the most commonly used is called Lupron. And Lupron as a drug is used also to chemically castrate convicted sex offenders. It's used as a form of chemical castration. It's used as a punishment, and it is currently being given and prescribed to children for what they call blocking puberty. This drug, as well, I just want to mention, has an interesting history as it was developed for treating prostate cancer in men, as some of your more interested listeners may know about that. But what I learned recently, too, was that it's actually sort of a derivative of a drug that was used to chemically castrate Alan Turing for being a homosexual. And I say derivative because it's not exactly the same drug. It was developed by the same company. So Abbott Pharmaceuticals developed the drug Alan Turing was given, which is called DES, or diethylstilbestrol. And then Abbott, the same company, developed Lupron a few years after DES was banned. And they're given for the same purposes, or I should say used to be, because DES is no longer used. So these two drugs, Lupron and DES, have been used for, quote unquote, feminizing hormone therapy for transgender women, according to their website, as well as chemical castration. DES was given for something called height dysphoria in youth at the time. So we're talking 60s. And nowadays, Lupron is given for gender dysphoria in children. So height dysphoria, gender dysphoria. So there's an obvious overlap there. And sorry, go ahead.
No, go ahead, please.
I wanted to bring this in again with the castration as a sadomasochistic fetish. So there has been some research that there are men who develop such a strong interest in BDSM that they then even fetishize the concept of castration, the fear and anxiety of castration, whether it's being threatened with it or acting it out in reality. And this is a quote that comes from research from 2008 called A Passion for Castration. And it says, a number of men have extreme castration ideations. Many only fantasize about castration. Others actualize their fantasies. So this group of researchers from Canada and California worked together on this research where they interacted and documented responses from men on a eunuch fetish website. And again, quoting the research, when asked about the origin of their interest in castration, respondents could select more than one factor. The majority selected sexual fantasy as their origin of interest in castration. The second most common origin of interest was a desire to reduce libido. So that's bringing it back to your point, Derek, that you mentioned earlier about St. Augustine, the overactive libido. When I try to talk about this, people, there's a tendency for people to divert to, well, if a man has undergone the surgery, and by the surgery, they might mean castration, right? Then for all intents and purposes, that person should be considered female. I would push back on that by first just stating that women are not castrated men. In the first place, and that it's insulting to insist that we're the same, that men, that women are castrated men. But also, you know, that this harm being done to children by giving them things like puberty blockers and wrong sex hormones is, in effect, it's what's being done to sex offenders, and it's being extended to children. So you can see what I think clearly is that the male sex drive or the male fetishization of castration is being extended onto children in order to naturalize it and normalize it.
So we have about 4 or 5 minutes left. And I know that a lot of what you've said has been, I think, probably pretty shocking to a lot of people, especially in the current climate, because anybody who says anything against this receives, you know, rampant rape and death threats. And nonetheless, I want to come back to reality and just remember that we're talking about a several thousand year history within patriarchy of a hatred of the body and of a mutilation of bodies through a myriad of forms with a myriad of justifications. But the fact remains that what we're really talking about is the, you know, we can put whatever language you want about it, but what we're still talking about is the removal of healthy generative organs. And I mean, that's something I wanted to say in this that just terrifies me, and that I find horrifying that there is a surgeon in, I believe, Florida, who makes joking TikTok videos about yeeting the teats and about, oh, I didn't get to yeet any teats today, by which she means she didn't get to remove the breasts of any women.
Dr. Gallagher, yes.
And I am stammering because I don't really understand how there can be an entire nation who celebrates the castration of a young boy who will never experience sex. He will never, a televised, you know, castration, essentially.
Yeah, Jess Jennings.
And I don't understand. I mean, I have been writing for more than two decades about how this culture is crazy, yet every time it's crazy, it surprises me. And I don't understand how we can. First, I don't understand how we can have a conversation in rational tones of voice about the castration, the sexual mutilation of a lot of people, young people especially. And two, even more so, I don't understand how we can not have a conversation about it where we're actually using the phrase mutilation. I don't understand how we can not have that conversation. So you've got a few minutes left, so just say anything you want, because the whole topic just horrifies me.
Yeah, look, I just really want to stress the internet's role in this again. It's absolutely fundamental in a lot of ways. So the first thing I would say is that these groups have been organizing for a while within the internet. By the groups, I mean the extremists, the BDSM extremists. Even the term BDSM comes from a Usenet forum in 1991. Prior to that, it was called SM. I mean, so there's been active mobilizing from these groups on the internet for decades now. So
as Gail Dines says, that even SM hides what we're really talking about, which is sadism.
Exactly. Well, then they turned it into BDSM, so now it's even more obscured. But so that factor has been there in the shadows for a long time. We're seeing it start to affect reality now. So, you know, the internet being used as a tool to actually affect change in reality, quite scary to me. But also, you know, we're in this age of influencers where things you see, you can't trust your eyes anymore. You know, what you see online can be so heavily edited. We have things like deep fakes coming on the horizon as well. So we can't even believe our own eyes anymore. Things that we see that we think are real that are not real. And a massive dissociation from our actual body. I think the rise in plastic surgery, the rise in influencers, and this false reality that's online is causing a lot of these problems. And we're all kind of under this spell, it seems to me, at the moment. And I don't know how we break out of it. If I did, I would happily tell everyone. I don't know how to break out of it. I think children should not be on the internet. I think that's one step. But what we have is really the adults who are leading this, actually. So there's a lot of pressure from children within gender ideology as a movement. But you've got to understand, too, that it's a result of a lot of the adults pushing things onto children, pushing things such as dissociation, pornography, their own fetishes onto children in order to use them in this capacity.
So to close, will you bring all of this back to patriarchy itself and the war on reality?
Yeah, so patriarchy itself is fundamentally about control and disdain for the body. What I think is happening is that this idea of the man-made body is superseding the woman-made body. We're meant to think that the man-made body is somehow more pure or holy than the woman-made natural body. Again, through plastic surgery and gender ideology, there almost seems to be a religious attribute towards, you know, coming out as transgender, as though you're almost born again and you become immediately brave and stunning and a good person. So the man-made body, yes?
John, I was just going to say, John McWhorter talks about wokeism itself as a religion. He says the only way to approach it, the only way to understand it is to understand it as a modern religion.
Mm-hmm. It absolutely is. It absolutely is to me, to my mind. And I think it's a religion that's very much tied up with pornography. I think pornography itself is becoming like another form of religion through BDSM practices.
And what's the Andrea Dworkin line about how
Any violation of women can become sex for men. That's the fundamental truth of pornography.
Oh, that's a good one. That wasn't what I was thinking, but that's a good one. The one I was thinking is it pornography is the theory, rape is the practice?
Mm-hmm. Was that, that might have been Robin Morgan.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry. I just, sorry about attributing the wrong person. Okay. So let's go back. Let's give you like three more sentences. Close us down. Somebody says, I heard this mind-blowing interview today. What was it about? It's like, oh God, it was about everything. And then, you know, what is the take-home message you want people to understand? Wait, I'm going to say one thing first, which is for me, the take-home message is we are our bodies and there is no mind-body separation. That's what I want people to take away. And what do you want people to take away?
I mean, I know it sounds really corny, but it's an act of rebellion these days to love your body. It is an act of political defiance to love yourself and to love other people as whole human beings rather than as pantomimes or false fabrications. So loving each other and loving yourself is one of the most radical things you can do in a culture where we're told that our own division, dissociation is meant to be freedom.
Well, thank you so much for that. And thank you for your work in the world. And I would like to thank listeners for listening. My guest today has been Genevieve Gluck. This is Derek Jensen for Resistance Radio on the Progressive Writing Network.